Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Meet the Pros seminar. Let me get my introduction done and we'll get right into the class. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending where in the world you are right now. It is our intention to bring you the top professionals in the field of hypnosis who can give you the inside scoop on the hypnosis business, our profession, as well as related topics such as NLP and self-help. Again, this is Cal Banyan, writer, author, hypnotherapist, and the developer of the 5-Path Hypnotherapy System and 7-Path Self-Hypnosis. I hope that you will check out our other websites, such as calbanyan.com, my blog where I have podcasts, www.hypnosiscenter.com for information about classes, and of course, once again, www.banyanhypnosismall, all kinds of great information. All right, today our speaker is, I'm so excited to be able to introduce to everybody our speaker. I am excited to introduce Del Hunter Morrill to you all. We've been working on this for months to get her on our Meet the Pros audio program. I know it's going to be worth it. Let me tell you all about Del. She's a counselor, a hypnotherapist, writer, teacher of hypnotherapy courses. She's known around the world. She's famous in the field of hypnosis. Del Morrill is a counseling hypnotherapist who has been using hypnosis as a major counseling tool in her practice since 1986. She's been active in personal and social development for over 30 years in Seattle, Japan, New York City, Chicago, and now in Tacoma, Washington. Del's training includes education at St. John's University, Center for Ethical Hypnosis, Kripalu Yoga Health Center, Institute of Cultural Affairs, Ecumenical Institute, Northwestern University, University of Washington. Del is certified member of the National Board of Professional and Ethical Standards, the Professional Board of Hypnotherapists. She's also a member of the American Association of Professional Hypnotherapists, the National Society of Clinical Hypnotherapists, and of course, one of my favorite organizations, the National Guild of Hypnotists. She is MS and CCH, counseling hypnotherapist. Del has a master's degree in clinical hypnotherapy, a bachelor's degree in psychology. She is certified in clinical hypnotherapy and a hypnobirther by St. John's University and is trained in pediatric hypnosis. Del was nominated Woman of the Year and Hypnosis Woman of the Century by the International Hypnosis Hall of Fame and honored as a lifetime member of the National Registry of Who's Who. She also sits on the advisory board of the Professional Board of Hypnotherapy. In addition, Del is the author of The Great Escapes, volumes of hypnotherapy scripts, and the New Beginning series of CDs. I'm very, very happy to have her as a contributor to our Banyan Hypnosis e-zine, where she writes articles for us. I'm so excited. She's such a class act. And now I would like to say welcome to Del Hunter Morrill. Del, tell us about yourself and how you got into the profession of hypnosis.
Hello, Hal, and however everyone else. I appreciate this time. I hope you'll forgive me if I get a little awkward with the electronics. I think I do better with hypnosis than with the electronical world, but I'll do my best. I got into hypnosis through my own physical and mental healing when I was extremely ill. It was one of the several natural resources that came my way, made it possible for me to heal. And as a result, it's led me a path, quite an extensive one, and here I am now. I won't go into a whole lot of detail about it, but I think it's helped me to become a better therapist because of the kind of difficult journey I went on. So here I am with it and enjoying it very, very much. I think I'm in my 18th year or something like that, am I? I didn't count it up, but something like that now in doing hypnosis, though I've been doing counseling now for over 40 years.
Thank you, Del. You know, I'm so glad to finally have you here face to face on the Meet the Pros audio program. I know that the work you've done has helped out so many hypnotherapists. I know that your Great Escapes hypnotherapy script books have been a great resource for the hypnotherapists at our center. I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit, just as we're getting started, before we get into the actual seminar, how did you get into writing scripts and then eventually start writing your books?
Well, basically, it came almost by accident. I shared a few scripts that I'd used, that is, I'd created in working with some children on learning issues. I shared them with some therapists on the Hypnosis Network on the internet, and people asked for them. Actually, they weren't in script form at that time. I had a habit of doing things with people and then not remembering what I'd done afterwards, so I began to put a tape in once in a while and try to capture what in the world I actually did with these people. And I ended up starting to write them out so that other people could actually use them. Soon after I shared those few scripts, wrote them out for people, I was asked to speak at the regional National Guild conference here on using hypnosis with children, which pushed me to put what I did have into a script book. And that's how the very first Great Escapes book came about. The time seemed right, since I had enough scripts for adults as well, to also come out with a second volume at that same time of scripts for adults and teens. And that's how it all began. It's just kind of snowballed from there.
That's interesting. So you started out with kids. For everyone that is listening to this Meet the Pros program, I want you to notice that on the screen in front of you, there is an outline of all the stuff we're going to go through, and there's also some links. One of the links is learn more about Dell's Great Escape Hypnosis Script Series, and the other one is click here to read Dell's latest article in the Banyan Hypnosis e-zine, Depress and Hypnotic Approaches. I think we got a typo there we're going to fix up. And click here to read Dell's previous article, Hypnotic Approaches to Anxiety, Fear, Panic Attacks. So I want you all to know that. You can click on those anytime you want, and then just click the back button and you can come back to where we are. All right, Dell, why don't you go ahead and get started with the seminar? I'm all ears, as they say.
This is focused on writing scripts. I never really thought of myself as any expert on that. It just seemed like the script evolved. However, I do have to give special recognition to Dr. Arthur Winkler, who influenced me a great deal on script writing because of his tremendous care with wording and with how you approach your clients in a little softer way than the very demanding kind of suggestions that have often been used in script writing. I also have to mention Dr. Winkler is the one who got me excited about working with children for the first time, because I'd been working with adults for some time before I started working with children. And he opened up that whole area for me a lot in terms of using one's imagination. So I wanted to first start with that, because my script writing is quite influenced by that, as well as some other folk out in the field that I appreciate very much. In script writing, I don't generally, even though I divide my books into inductions and then prescriptions and deepeners and that sort of thing, I actually, when I write a script, say an induction, I'm including in that induction most frequently the deepening technique itself, including suggestions on self-esteem and so forth. So I see it all as one wonderful evolving thing going on when I'm working with a client that just moves. Sometimes with just an induction is enough because it holds so many other facets in it. In the first induction, I'm particularly careful to include what I would have given to them at a conscious state in terms of explaining hypnosis. In other words, when I meet someone for the first time, I have them watch a CD or DVD that has is a little short interview that was done on I had done on television that explains hypnosis. Then after that, when I'm ready to work with them on hypnosis itself, I go over what it isn't and what it is, the usual traditional things where you're clearing the air, making sure people understand. But then when I do the induction, I'm also at a different level of consciousness, going over that same material one way or another so that their subconscious mind is not afraid to make those changes that need to be made because of fears that haven't been handled.
Del, let me tell you, you're doing a great job. This is just exactly the kind of stuff we want to hear. You're handling the technology great. You know, about every minute or so, unclick. It'll give me a chance to come in here and talk a little bit, ask questions. And also, sometimes the internet just has to breathe a little bit and let the data stream catch up. So this is beautiful. I'm curious, as I'm hearing about this, do you sometimes coach other people, or do you give classes very frequently on script writing?
I do classes on this subject along with other subjects. I think my favorite classes are four classes I do quite a bit of. One is on script writing, effective script writing for real change. Another is on advanced techniques. I call it when suggestions aren't enough, and that basically has to do with healing the past, especially abuse and other trauma. Then the third one that I, of course, I work with is, of course, working with children and preteens. And a fourth one is on how to have a successful business. I'm a full-time hypnotherapist and have been all these years, but I also made sure I've learned a lot about marketing and business management. Anyway, those are the courses I teach the most, although I certainly have had taught others as well. But yes, I do teach courses on script writing. I'm always glad to do that whenever I can get some time away from clients.
Beautiful. I'm curious, when you do those script writing courses, I'm sure you get people in who believe they're already pretty good at it. And what kind of problems do you see that some people have when they write scripts?
Good question, and certainly one that I go over when I'm teaching classes on it. I think one of them is this tremendous separation between I'm going to induce somebody, and then I'm going to deepen what I just did, and then I'm going to. In other words, this step by step by step process that can be kind of limiting. Secondly, sometimes people are taught a very small number of ways to help people become induced and to help them with their healing process. So I would say limitation on methods is one thing that can happen with script writing, where there's not enough material to be able to be flexible. Second one is the content of the scripts. I'm amazed at the number of scripts that come off very negatively. If there's any way to avoid a no or not, I try to avoid it and find another way to come at a statement, but that doesn't mean you can always avoid it. And I don't happen to agree with some idea that the unconscious mind doesn't accept a no. I mean, it says accepts. When you say you'll not do something, it accepts it as you'll do it. I don't see that there's any evidence to that, because if I tell my child don't run out in the road, that they will hear it as don't run out into the road. I don't see that's any different with hypnosis. However, I do believe the use of negative words a lot in a script is uncreative generally, and that it keeps reinforcing the problem by saying you're not going to do this or that. So finding a way to say as often as possible what you do want, what that person does want for themselves, is what I would emphasize in writing the script.
So what I'm understanding is that you have a certain approach to writing hypnosis scripts. You have a certain style that you feel works the best. Can you kind of summarize that up for us?
I think when I'm doing a script, and basically my scripts aren't written ahead of time. My scripts come out of working with particular clients. So therefore all the scripts in my books have actually been used with particular clients rather than created ahead of time or something. A lot comes out of my intuitions. Some of it comes out of a springboard from someone else's work. Sometimes I get a story in my mind. I'll take off on some flight of fancy with a story or a kind of metaphor. Those things come freely sometimes. Other times they don't. But my basic philosophy is keeping in mind that two things. One is three things. One, whenever a person comes in for something, whether it's to get rid of smoking or whether it's to get rid of depression, it doesn't matter how, whether it's a habit or a serious long-time chronic problem, the unconscious mind is a conservative thing and it doesn't like change. It's like even the worst comfort zone is at least something the person knows. And therefore, when they come in for change, the first thing it has to be dealt with is to help them be unafraid to make the changes. So that's important to build into my scripts. The second thing is the person, no matter who they are, needs to believe in themselves, to have a faith in what they're doing, to believe that they can do it. And so therefore the person's confidence level is in my mind all the time, how to keep building that. The third thing, of course, is winning. Whatever they've come for, it's an assurance that yes, they can do this. In fact, it's already being done. And I think the fourth thing would be sending them away with a conviction that this has worked. So it's like I end my scripts by telling them that basically I always do a good job. I don't say it that way, but it's like they can count on seeing results. They can count on experiencing change. They can count on this having worked and that it will continue working even after they leave this room. So I guess those are the things I keep in my mind as I am creating the scripts. My scripts are quite varied, so you may not find all of those things in every single script, but those are in the forefront of my mind as I'm working with people.
All right, yeah, that's very useful. Now, I'm kind of taking notes as we go along so I can kind of read back some main ideas. That tends to help the listeners. So one of the things I'm picking up on is these are not kind of canned scripts that you make up ahead of time, but these are real scripts that were used in real sessions with real clients. And another thing is that you like to let your kind of intuition mix with your experience to produce the suggestions that your clients need at the moment. And also that you are of the opinion that the unconscious mind is a conservative thing and that you want to always make sure that in your scripts and with the work you do with your clients that they know that it is safe to change and that they can believe in themselves and that they can go away expecting results. Is that right?
You're on target. It's exactly right. I also want to make sure that I am universal in my script writing. You will find that I give people choices on how they approach things philosophically and religiously. I don't have a particular religious perspective that I put into my scripts because I do want them to be able to be used by everyone, whether they are Christian, Muslim, Jew, Buddhist, or agnostic, or even atheist. I try to make sure that my scripts can be indeed used by anyone and at any time. When I work with the children's scripts, I've tried to make them in such a way, when I've gone back to edit them, for instance, to make sure that there's something that also can be used by other people who work with children, parents, teachers, and others who are working a lot with children. Of course, with the others, for the adults and teens, basically those are strictly for people who know their hypnotic work. I also want to recognize, though, other people who have written some exceptional scripts that I do use at times, or I will adapt extensively. In fact, sometimes I'll use someone's imagery, like an image. For instance, I created one for children and then adapted it for adults called The Star, the Worry Tree, and the Garden. That image comes from another writer of a book of children's imagery. And I use that to launch into my own script. So sometimes I'll take some section like this, someone's image, and then I'll jump into some kind of story or suggestions.
That's really useful. I like the fact that you use a very generalized script approach, and also that it's not biased to one particular ethnicity or religiosity. Adele, I'm wondering, perhaps some of the people in our virtual classroom here are not really sure what you meant by metaphor. Can you tell us a little bit what you mean by that?
Perhaps I'm not using the word metaphor properly, but I usually mean where I'm telling a story or giving an example sometimes that, it may be built into a script, or sometimes I may insert it myself into my own scripts. I do tend to use stories and some metaphors. Because I tend to be a fairly rational person, I don't find all metaphors helpful for me to use, but I mean by metaphor some kind of imagery or story that's telling, maybe subtly telling something. Like an example for me would be a story of the woman who sheds layers as she's led from a cold climate to a very hot one. She keeps shedding layers. This is used a lot. I use this a lot with weight control, but I also can use it with people who carry around a lot of burdens, which leads me, Cal, to mention one of the major things I work with is getting at the source of problems. Now, I use what I call a problem-solving script. It's something, basically what I've done is I ask the subconscious self, some part of that mind, to seek out whatever the imprints are that are causing the basic problem, and then to release them or to change them into something more helpful to the client who is now an adult in a different time of their life. I often will use this before any other kind of problem-seeking script. That is, before I would use, for instance, regression. Oftentimes, this means regression is unnecessary, although I'm also capable of working with regression techniques to go to the source of the problem. When I'm working with scripts, one of the main things I'm concerned about when I'm working with any client is how did they get started with whatever's going on, even if it's how did they get started smoking. I believe that the subconscious self has no concept of time, and therefore whatever goes on that happens in your life is there in your mind as an imprint, and those imprints stay there in the time that they were given. Since there's no concept of time in the subconscious mind, then it means that all things are now. So one of the things I do, another technique I use to get at the source and release problems, is to talk to that part of the person, that age when it began, and remind them that time has changed. Each of my books, particularly the later ones, all have significant sections on various releasing techniques, techniques that help search out problems and techniques that help release them. So this is a major part of my work and a major part of my script writing. So I often include a little bit of it in different scripts, even in inductions, seeking the source of the problem. But I also have scripts that go into it in more detail.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like we've got topics we can do in the future for additional Meet the Pros programs. I think it'd be interesting to do a topic on how to get to the source of the problem without age regression and that kind of thing. I do like your comment. I find it very interesting that the subconscious mind or the unconscious mind has no sense of time. I think that's a very interesting comment. I'm wondering, earlier we were talking about hypnotic inductions. Do all of your script books have hypnotic inductions, or are they mainly in one book more than another?
All my books, with the exception of the last ones I just did, have a section on various inductions. I have very few repeats in any of my books. The exception is the last two volumes I made, which started out to be one volume, ended up being so big and so much material that I divided into two, and that's volumes 5 and 6. In that instance, I put all of the inductions into volume 5. I also put all of the seeking of solutions and releasing techniques in that volume as well. I put affirmations and sort of like a miscellaneous book. And while volume 6 is strictly what I call prescriptions, that is, two specific issues.
Great. Now, one of the things I want to make sure is in this time we have together that we cover everything that I've got in that outline. So one of the things that, have we covered yet number 3, what needs to be included in each script? Have we covered all you want to talk about that item?
Well, this will probably be like any lecture I ever give. When I leave the stage, I always think of all the things I should have said. Okay, so bearing that in mind, that I probably will finish this and think afterwards of all the things I could have included, I'll try to be as inclusive as possible. One of the things that I neglected to mention that's an important part of my script writing is I have found so many scripts that rely on a person being very visual. Because I don't happen to be a person who's real visual, at least able to hold visual things for very long time, long periods of a time, on my inductions, they're quite varied. I have things that, inductions that are all words. There are no pictures involved for people who aren't visualizers. And then I have some that are definitely visualizations. I have scripts that are based on nature, since I live in an area that's heavy with all kinds of wonderful natural sights. I have ones that are very brief for people who've been doing hypnosis for a while. And I have some that are longer, where people need to be able to get into it a little more easily. One of the things about my script writing has to do with the kind of clients I get. I get a lot of clients who've been very hurt in their lives. They've been very abused. And therefore, the language, that's part of what has to do with how I choose my language. I don't want to be terribly authoritative. They've had enough of that. Most of them have lived lives where someone's had power over them for a long time. When I'm teaching about scripts, when I'm looking at other people's scripts, when I do my own, I try to be cautious about how I use words so that they're more gentle oftentimes, and they allow people to take their time getting into the experience. They don't assume that they should immediately get into it, nor does it assume that they should be experiencing what I think they should be experiencing. So when I'm thinking of wording things, I try not to force people into visualizing something that isn't there or into acting in a way or responding in a way that they aren't really responding. I'm trying to give them an out, if you will, and give them possibilities of various ways they can experience the hypnotic process.
You often advise working with people who have been hurt in their lives to take more of a permissive and allowing or client-centered approach. I think that's beautiful. I'm wondering, I'm going down to number 4 on this list now. How is writing for adults different for writing for children?
Well, With children, first of all, I found that children change more rapidly than adults, that oftentimes one simple single session with them will do the job that maybe takes longer with adults. And I'm not going to go into a long lecture on how children are different, but I think it's because their imaginations are so keen and they're in a hypnotic state most of the time and they don't argue about what's real and what isn't real. Therefore, I use their imaginations a lot. And I also use storytelling more than I probably do with adults. However, I'm getting to more and more see the value and try to use stories more with adults as well, because you're speaking to the adult child just as much with an adult. But with children, I would say the scripts I have are even more varied. Everything from the most simple kind of thing with a 3- and 4-year-old to working with preteens where you can treat them like adults practically. So everything from some unique little thing like playing with a puppet, hypnotizing them with a puppet, or having them hypnotize you with the puppet, those kinds of things, or taking the kid on a journey after finding out his favorite things and his favorite friends and that sort of thing, creating a journey in which the child becomes the hero or heroine of that journey, and it can solve his problem. Giving kids power, finding ways to give them power. So sometimes I'll have them create their own journeys by simply having them imagine themselves with a wand in their hands or a laser or something else in some situation. I do all kinds of things that it's a little hard for me to explain quite without having something I can show you in front, but I have magic boxes that have magic stones that heal, and there are all kinds of things that maybe an adult would put their hands up and say, hey, that's not going to work, but a kid believes it will, and therefore a magic stone you can rub on your head to make your headache go away is as great a hypnotic method as any I can think of.
That's great. I can tell you've got a lot of experience working with children. You know, every time we do one of these seminars, I'm one of the great challenges is I want to make sure that everybody walks away from the seminar with something they could use tomorrow if they had the opportunity. I'm wondering if you could kind of give us, off the top of your head, you've probably done it 1,000 times, just a little induction that you'd use on a child, for example.
Challenge you give me off the top of my head. These are so dependent on who the child is. But let me think a minute. The child comes into me and his parents despair because he cannot get his homework done. It takes him 3 to 4 hours a night doing his homework. He's not very old, actually. He's probably 8 years old, and he's still doing 3 and 4 hours of homework every night. So with a child, I don't really do a formal induction when he's that age, or I ask him, you know, what is it that he would rather be doing than his homework? He tells me he wants to play with his friends. I say, what do you most like to play with your friends? He says he likes to play soccer. So I take him on a little trip, and I start with a star and tree in the garden. He goes in a garden. He goes down a path, and down the path, at the end of the path is a boat. And he gets in that boat. And by the way, this child also, this is a specific one I'm telling you about because it's hard for me to just give one as if you were the child, I hope you don't mind. The child also had recently lost his grandmother, who was very dear to him. So I had him come to the river where the boat was and find that his grandmother was standing there waiting for him. So he asked her to go in the boat with him. So he took his grandmother on a ride in the boat. The boat goes along in this wonderful stream and ends up in a tunnel. In the tunnel, there's a ledge running along, and there are doorways along the ledge, all kinds of doorways. And he goes to a doorway that's called soccer. He gets out, and goes through the door, and there are his friends waiting for him in the soccer field, and he gets to play with them and has a wonderful time. He says goodbye, gets back in the boat with his grandmother, and they have this wonderful trip backward, coming back to the garden, in which he says his goodbyes to his grandmother. He's able to say goodbye to his grandmother. Now, when he's back, before he gets out of that story, that is before he's fully awake, I remind him that any time he gets tired while he's doing homework, all he has to do is stop and close his eyes and go back to his soccer field in his dream, play a little while, and then come back and do his homework. Now, I don't know what went on at home, but I got a call from the parent who said her husband said, "Who is this child I have in my house?" Because the child got his homework done within 45 minutes to an hour at the most from that point on. So that's just an example of what I might do with a child who's having a little trouble. With another child, all she needs, she was 6 years old, having a lot of trouble making friends. So I took her on a little trip across the rainbow where she met the rainbow people who accepted her, loved her, wanted her to play with them. And she was going to go to a new school, so I told her when she goes to the new school, she can imagine that she's coming into the rainbow land and she's meeting these rainbow people who will really like her and love her. And it seemed to work. Those kind of things work with kids really well. And it's a matter of just letting our own imaginations go, you know, just believing in ourselves, letting ourselves, our imaginations are so, we've let them get so limited because of our whole thing about what's real, what isn't, are you telling a lie, are you telling the truth, et cetera, that we don't trust ourselves. And so working with children just means, hey, enjoy the play and use the play and find out what the kids like to do and then use it some way in creating a story. A formal induction is rarely necessary if you start storytelling, although I do use them too with kids, depends on who they are. I use a pendulum with children to show them how powerful their mind is, not as a requirement for them to look at and go to sleep, so to speak. No, I have them hold it and make it go around, make it go back and forth so they can see how powerful their mind is, and then they get to show their parent how it works, and their parent, it excites them. So that's probably one of the most simple inductions I work with, because a lot of times then I just let them use the pendulum, have it moving in their own hand, and have it get heavier and heavier until it drops in their lap, and then they're ready to go. Kids will open their eyes, wiggle around in the chair, do all kinds of things that you and I wouldn't expect in an adult. But with kids, they do fine. They receive it all, even when they open their eyes and talk to me and then go back into it. So it all depends on the child and what they need and how old they are on what I do as an induction.
You know, Del, I'm really enjoying chatting with you about this. And I want to tell everybody that's listening in, if you've got an interest in working with children, you want to pursue that. They're going to be the easiest people you work with. And gosh, if you have a client, when do you want to help them? When they're, you know, 7, 17, or, you know, 107. The sooner we can help our clients, the better, the easier there is. And from a business point of view, there's usually more money available to help the children than the adults. A lot of times a parent wouldn't spend the money on themselves, but they'd spend it on their kids. Good. Thank you very much, Del. Now, we got to get through this material. I'm sure we could do a 3-hour seminar, but I want to make sure that we at least get through the stuff we promised, okay? So I see on our list, we said, what are the optimum lengths for hypnosis scripts? So I guess there would be like an optimum length for grown-ups in certain kind of circumstances and then for kids in others. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I don't know how to answer that, because I have some scripts for children and some scripts for adults that seem very long, but they're going through a whole process. That is, they're doing the whole job of inducting, deepening, giving confidence and the whole works, so they're longer. I have some that are half a page, and most of them are at least a page long. And then, of course, if I want really short inductions, I don't have to write them because there are enough people who have created, have written about other scripts. I use some of those if I need to. So I don't use just my own scripts all the time. But I don't know that there's an optimum list. I'm not a believer in the idea that you should only use short, fast stuff. I personally, those are helpful at times, and then other times they're not. The idea of snapping your fingers and telling someone to sleep comes out of stage hypnosis, and it's very effective for many people. But understand that I'm working with people where a lot of them would be kind of nervous with that because they're trying to get over the idea of what it looks, the idea that some hypnotist is making them do something. And so I tend to go into, for that reason and for the reason that most of my clients are stressed in life, they've got a lot of stress, I tend to use their breath and relaxation response the most in getting them into hypnosis. The rest of the process is not so much getting into hypnosis, but taking them on a journey from that point into getting rid of the imprints, into giving them courage, giving them confidence, or telling them about hypnosis and what it really is about, whatever it is, and whenever I'm using it, depending on when I'm using it in the process, when I'm working with people, with children. It can be a simple story. Usually it's a little longer story because they're going on an adventure in which something has to be solved. Again, some of them can be really short, though. It all depends on the person. It depends on what they've come for. It depends on their nervousness and their comfort zone.
How about, I see in my list of questions, what's the best way to end a script?
I think it's helpful to end a script, or at least most of them, to remind the person that they're on their way to getting to their goal, or that they're already in the process of winning, to assure them that this is a process that works for them, to mention that their self-confidence, their self-reliance is growing, their self-esteem is deepening every day, and that whatever we've done this day is in the storehouse of their mind, in every aspect of their being, in every cell of their body. It's working. It'll continue to work even after they leave this place or this room, whatever. Those kinds of things, I think, are always important to close. And then when I bring them out of hypnosis, I count to five. I know everybody's different on this. With certain clients who have trouble, I might count to 10 if they have trouble coming out of the hypnotic state. But most of them, I count to five. And with each number, I remind them of their goal, or that their goal is being, they're meeting their goal, whatever it is, that so that because they're coming up in different levels, that as they come up into a full wakefulness, they're going through different levels, just like they did when they went down into the hypnotic state. And so with each level they're coming up, with each number, I'm reminding them again that they are, in fact, meeting their goal, and they're gaining more confidence, they're this and that, and like weight control clients will say, and soon you'll be that 125-pound person you want to be. You'll be healthy and happy and confident, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm giving confidence statements and goal-oriented statements all the way at the end and coming up out of the hypnotic state.
I really like what you're saying there, that right after they emerge, you're still giving them suggestions. Is that right?
I am. I believe that it's helpful, and it's not only, I feel like coming out of the hypnotic process is not just giving them time to come out of that, but it's also to confirm at every level they're coming up through. I don't know if you want to call it level, whatever stages they're coming up in terms of all those states of being they've been in. As they come up, they're going through those states of being, and each state of being needs to confirm that this is so, this is true, and that they can do it.
Beautiful. As we talk together, I can really hear that you were influenced by Dr. Winkler. I'm also, I see on our list of things to cover that you have an opinion about ideal motor response. Is that right?
For reminding me about that, right. I do use idiomotor responses a lot. I use them in full when I want to, if I feel like we need to find out what's causing something and say that the problem-solving script never didn't do its full job. So we've got to find out what the basic cause of a problem is. So I'll use that, asking many questions, and have a person usually using their fingers to respond yes or no. But I also use it within scripts at times if I'm taking people on a journey. For instance, some releasing method where they're dumping problems. I'm a great one for having people dump problems. I have them go under a waterfall and be washed from all this stuff they're carrying around with them. Or I have them load a ship and burn it, whatever it takes. If a person comes in with a lot of symptoms, I'll use ideomotor to have them guide me along so I'm staying with them. If I'm using a visual induction, I'm going to have them respond with a yes or no finger as to whether they actually are feeling or sensing or seeing what I'm talking about. By the way, when I use visual, I often will say, do you see it or sense it or imagine it? I don't just choose the visual word. And so the ideomotor responses can be very helpful. There are also times when I find that only the ideomotor response will allow something to go on. For instance, I'm trying to think how to say this. If I'm helping someone, well, it's an advanced work of getting rid of somebody else's energy off of you, somebody's burden that you're carrying around. And it's helpful to dialogue with the client to know what's going on. Or if I'm, say, using a technique where they are to talk to a perpetrator who did them harm, where I would rather have them verbally dialogue so I can hear it and ask questions, etc. But the client isn't up to doing that for one reason or another. Either they're too deep, maybe, or they just don't want to verbalize. In that case, I have to count on the ideomotor responses to what's going on. So I'm very much guided by that, and I do believe it's a very effective tool as long as one makes sure that it is coming from the subconscious mind and it's not just conscious responses.
Beautiful. All right. Next, I'd like to know a little bit about the releasing methods. Tell us what a releasing method is, and if you could give us, you know, one or two more examples, I think that would be very useful for the listeners.
All right, I'm going to, there are two kinds of releasing methods I use. That's two types. I call one dumping methods, where you dump problems, which I've mentioned before. That's where someone can throw rocks out into the lake, each rock with labeled with something that's a problem, or they drop sandbags out of a hot air balloon that has each symptom or problem or person that's imprisoning them some way. So if someone's got a bunch of problems, symptoms, people that are still keeping them in bondage, whatever it is, and I often find that true with people who have depression, anxiety, chronic illness, or people who've had abuse in their background, etc. So those are the dumping ones where there's several things involved. The other kind are releasing methods. That is, once you've discovered the source of something, or you know at what age something began, that an example of this, which I find extremely effective, is to actually call out. Just say, I want to talk to the 12-year-old Bill. Sometimes you may say, I want to talk to the 12-year-old Bill. I want to talk to the 5-year-old Bill. Please come forward. I want to talk to you. In that moment, the 5-year-old Bill and the 12-year-old Bill literally become your clients. Now, in that method, what I do is I talk to them and I say, I'm talking to the ones who were so hurt, who wanted their parents to love them, who wanted their this, or they, who was left behind, whatever the issues are. I just go through it. Who was so hurt, who was worries about being left, etc., whatever the issue is. So I describe the emotions that child went through, not the adult, but the child went through in that time of their life. Because I'm talking to them because they don't know time has changed. They think it's still now. Whatever went on in their life, say someone who was literally abused, they think it's still going on. They think the person that abuses them is still there, scaring them, there to take away their power, whatever. They believe that. It's not the adult who believes it. It is that child within that believes it. So I tell the child, I tell them, you have to understand, you are now grown up and you no longer have to be afraid. You now are in charge of your life. You're as an adult. You have all the power in the world you need. Time has changed, and everything that happened to you now are merely memories, and memories are words, and words have no power over you. Memories have no power over you. And I may say that several times through that, interspersed with how wonderful they are, that they're a good child, they deserve goodness, they deserve love. I go through talking about how the child, what the child needs, and encouraging them, and then assuring them that everything they feared is now out of their life. It's no longer there to be fearful about, no longer there to worry about. Then I end that usually by having the adult client, the adult, assures the child that they're loved. They say whatever they want to say. I have the adult say whatever they need to say to the child. If the adult doesn't speak, then I speak for them, assuring the child they're cared for, they're loved now, they never have to be afraid again, or they never have to be hurt again, whatever the child needs. And then I have them actually do one of two things. Either merge together, the adult and the child merge together, reminding, say, that the child's part in the adult's life, the child is there to help that adult be loving and kind and to have fun, and the adult is there to help the child feel safe and secure and believe they're loved, know they're loved. Or I'll have the adult put them in some place in their body, that child, some place in their body where they can feel safe and secure. But some technique like that, I'm not saying those are the only techniques, but this is just an example of a releasing technique. There are a lot of other kinds as well, but I use this one quite a bit because of the nature of a lot of the clients who come to see me.
Del, is that technique in any of your books?
Yes, I believe it's in volume 3.
Great. Well, you know, we're getting short on time. I would like to ask you to allow some people to ask some questions. Is that all right with you?
It's fine with me. I hope I can answer them.
Okay, I'm going to start off by asking a question. After you answer it, then the floor will be open, so to speak, for anyone else to just either type in at the bottom where it says your message, or you can hit the talk now button if you have a microphone. But feel free to just type in your message at the bottom, and I can ask them of Del if you don't have a microphone. Okay, here's one of the questions I have for you. What do you wish more hypnotists and hypnotherapists would do with their clients to make our profession better?
Well, I'd like more of our more people to in our profession to expand the techniques they use. I'd like to see them use more releasing of causes of things and releasing those from a person's life, finding different techniques, because I do believe that many things going on in a person's life are are caused by things that give them trouble in many ways, and why not get rid of the reason for them? Why not in working with a smoking client? Why not talk to the 14-year-old who began smoking and assure them that it's no longer what they think it is? The time has changed, and it's no longer cool to smoke. It's stinky and, you know, whatever else. I mean, why not talk to that 14-year-old? I'd like to see more therapists work with things that have been stuck in the past. I'd like to see more of them less dogmatic language that seems so common. I'd like to see more storytelling, I'd like to see more scripts that are more word oriented than just assuming everybody is visual. That seems to be very big. That seems to be a very big thing in script writing, I noticed.
Wonderful. I see a question here from Lynn. It says, what induction works best for you, for analytical people?
Well, I find if I'm working with an analytical people that what I talked about earlier about including your pre-talk in your induction, the things you talked about as what hypnosis is and isn't that you bring up in your induction, just reminding them of that they're in charge. They've got to be reminded they're in charge, the analytical person, because they believe in their mind as being in charge of things, you know. So, you know, you're reminding them they're in charge. You're reminding them that they're the ones saying yes or no. You know what I tell them? I tell people like that, you know, there are a lot of books written on hypnosis, and I do, you know, I can teach 2 years on it easily, et cetera. I've got a lot of training, but it all boils down to this. Not so much the depth of trance you go into. It's all about you, my giving suggestions, and you accepting them or not accepting them. And you're always in charge of that. So it's assuring them that way. With the analytical, a lot of times, too, I'll do a roving script, you know, like I do a relax in nature, where I just take them on little trips from one place to another where they have no time to think too much. They'll kind of rove around or wander around. The Ericksonian type scripts sometimes are helpful for that, where you're just kind of meandering around, maybe sometimes getting into a story or whatever.
Good. Hey, one of our staff just asked me a question to ask you. How long is a typical hypnosis session with you?
The first hypnosis session, my first visit, is all intake, except for, say, athletic stuff and smokers. Everything else, mostly, I take a whole hour and a half or an hour and 45 minutes with a person and do a fairly serious intake of a lot of questions, getting acquainted, etc. And that is a really important time, I found, rather than moving too quickly into hypnosis. The sessions after that, then, I take all that information, I create a summary sheet that I make up, and then of all the stuff they've given me, no priority to it, just notes of what it is they actually told me. Then I go over that with the client in the next session and do the first induction with them, which I use induction one, or with people who I think are going to get too caught up in words, I'll use relax in nature or something like that.
I just got another question from one of our staff members. Do you do depth testing or convincers in the sessions you do?
Do I use convincers and things that convince a person? Of course, they're hypnotized. The first induction, I just about always, unless there's someone who's been used to hypnosis before, if they haven't had it before, I always include the eye closure induction. If that hasn't satisfied someone, like at the end of the session, they aren't satisfied, however, I get very little of that, but if they aren't convinced, then I'll take them through a series the next time of different things. I'll try that use different senses. And I will tell them they're not testing for hypnosis. I just say, I want to see what will work best with you when I'm working with hypnosis with you. And I'll take them through things like the lemon, you know, the squeezing the lemon in the mouth, that visual, and uses other senses. I will use a stiff arm or the clasp hands, where you clasp the hands and can't open them, the eye closure. I usually end, if I'm doing a series of these with someone that I suspect will have trouble. By the way, that's also good for analytical people at the beginning. I will have them pretend to be a big hourglass where the top is filled with sand that's sifting down and down and down, filling their feet and their legs and packing it down with fine sand. And when it gets up to their waist, all the sand from the top is now in the bottom of the hourglass. Then I have them try to lift their leg and notice how heavy it is. Then I have the sand drift out of the soles of their feet back into the earth until every last speck is done, and then lift the leg again. That's a pretty good convincer, by the way, and it's a little fun. But during those times, I'm not telling them anything about convincing them about anything. I'm really conning them into believing that it has to do with how I'll work with them in hypnosis. By the way, someone's been putting up a note here about how I work with depression. And by the way, also this question on convincers in the books. Yes, I think I may have, but you know, some of these things, so many therapists use them, so many hypnotherapists, that my books are not so much out to repeat what other people have written so frequently about. Probably in my volume 2, I may have had some. I honestly don't remember right at the moment, and I don't have it in front of me. But I probably have it somewhere in one of the books. But most of these things other therapists have in their books, you know, frequently.
Del, you were going to say something about depression?
I noticed that someone had asked that question about how I work with depression. I'm quite aware that there are a lot of hypnotherapists that think you shouldn't work with it. I'm a counselor. I've been trained as a counselor also. I recommend that if people are going to work with depression, they need to get some counseling behind them. They need to know something about psychology. In fact, I wish every extensive hypnosis course had some stuff on psychology, general psychology, abnormal psychology, and counseling practices. It can be extremely beneficial addition to our practice to make us more effective and to help us be able to work with things like depression and anxiety and other things. With depression, I definitely take my time in an induction, in an interview with that person. I'll have sent out stuff ahead that people fill out, where they check off things about how their feelings, their self-talk, whatever. And I help them working with the depression thing, the first thing I'm going to do with those people, and with people who've been abused or anything, or people with low self-esteem, is I just tell them I think they're absolutely fantastic people. Isn't it wonderful what they've been able to do with their lives in the light of what's gone on in their life? And isn't it fantastic that here they are? Because that shows a tremendous amount of courage to be here. When a lot of people don't make it. They don't make it. The first thing I do with any client who comes in is depressed, has low self-esteem, terrible self-talk, or has had abuse in their background, etc., often which are all intermingled, is I'm going to tell them what a wonderful person they are, how courageous of them that they have come through it. Here they are in this office doing something about themselves. And a lot of people in their situation have never made it. They haven't made it. And here they've come through it. And aren't they courageous? Aren't they wonderful? I find some way to, first of all, counteract immediately their attitude about themselves. And then I'm going to find out everything I can about how they feel, what their self-talk is, etc. By a very extensive interview, I take my time with it. I'm not going to rush them on the hypnosis end of things. I will assume, I find out what their history is, what incidences have happened in their life, when depression began, what was going on then. Is it the depression they felt all their lives? Is it depression that began at a certain point in their life? Is it ongoing depression, or is it come in clouds? Because depression is very different from person to person. Some depression is temporary. It comes from grief over some incidents. Grief over finances, grief over the loss of someone, grief over moving, whatever it might be. Some of it is somebody will say, I don't know, I've been depressed all my life. So I have to find out what they mean by all my life. Oftentimes they'll say, well, actually, it was since junior high or something like that. It's very important to find out how they feel when it came, what was going on then, if it comes intermittently, if you can find out what's going on. I also ask them if they've had their thyroid checked, because low thyroid output can cause depression. I find out whether a doctor's checked them over, in other words. But I will ask that. It's so much that each person is so different. Sometimes I often use them getting washed in a waterfall, a cleansing waterfall for people like that. It's a very effective. Gets rid of a lot of the side stuff, you know, the extraneous symptoms, so you can work on the specific ones. I certainly work with problem solving, getting at the imprints that are causing the depression and having them changed into something more helpful. I'll use idiomotor questioning to find out where the problem stems from if I need to. Then I will use regression if it's necessary. I certainly have scripts that I've created on lifting depression. I certainly will work with self-esteem. I have a lot of scripts I've created out of that. It's a fairly extensive thing and shouldn't be rushed. So I would say, you know, with some depressed client, the minimum is 10 sessions after that initial interview for me, and sometimes longer, but usually about that. Works pretty well. Some of them will experience a lifting of depression right away, so maybe 5 sessions for them. But you need to take your time with them. And I think any training you can get that helps you be a better counselor, because counseling methods are really helpful too.
All right. You know, I'm sure we could go on and on and on. And certainly we've brought up a number of different topics that we could do seminars in the future. First of all, I want to thank you, Del, for taking the time to get online and to do this. And I'll tell everybody that's listening right now or in the future, if you want to contact Del, contact her through our website and click on the Contact Us. We'll forward any messages to her or any questions you have about her materials. Also, I want to just say, go ahead and type in a little message in the bottom if you want to Del. I know a lot of you don't have microphones or webcams, so please go ahead and do that. Let's see. That's it. We're done for another Meet the Pros audio program. Just to close up, remember that we have our NGH certification course here at our center in Tustin, California. I want to see everybody at the Solid Gold Weekend in Las Vegas. And gosh, that's it. I'm going to sign off now. Well, if you have any questions about what we're doing, please give us a call at 714-258-8380. You can also contact me by going to the mall, www.banyanhypnosismall.com. And I'm getting a thank you from Del. Del's saying, thank you guys for being here. Together, we all made it a great little seminar, and people everywhere around the world are going to be listening to this and learning. So once again, thank you everyone in our virtual classroom. Thank you everyone listening wherever you are in the world. Thank you, Del. This is Cal Banyan, over and out. Hello again. Just to wrap things up, I want to say thanks again to this hypnosis professional for allowing us to make this Meet the Pros Hypnosis Training Seminar available to you for free. We always appreciate it when you tell others about this Meet the Pros Hypnosis Training Seminar here on this website, www.hypnosis.org. Keep checking back to find the latest Meet the Pros Hypnosis Training Seminar on www.hypnosis.org, where we organize hypnosis training and materials for you. on hypnosis.org. Remember, that ends with O-R-G. You will find the latest hypnosis information, training materials, course listings, and information about individual hypnosis sessions for you. I also want to suggest that you stop by my web blog, that's www.calbanyan.com, where you'll find lots of newly updated free hypnosis training videos, news announcements, opinions, and more. Until next time, this is Cal Banyan, signing off. This recording is the property of Cal Banyan and Cal Banyan's Banyan Publishing Incorporated. All rights reserved, for private use only, may not be duplicated without written permission.